Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS Viewed, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, the podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where Curtis McGiffin, Jim Petrosky, and I, Adam Wilder, like to, you know, sit around and discuss current topics of the day, great articles we've read, things that are, you know, sort of going on in the news as it relates to deterrence, oftentimes nuclear, but, you know, we talk China and Russia and some other interesting topics as well. And this, I guess today's Friday when we're recording this. And so earlier this week was the Deterrence Summit, which is, you know, it's put on by the Exchange Monitor, which is a publication that covers Department of Energy and NSA. And so the Deterrence Summit is essentially the big conference for NNSA. And, you know, it happens the last week of January-ish every year. You know, it's kind of the counterpart to the STRATCOM Symposium, which happens usually in August of every year. And so in, you know, STRATCOM Symposium, you get the sort of the DOD perspective on nuclear strategic topics. And then the Deterrence Summit, you get the NNSA view on everything, you know, everything related to the complex. So it's, you know, two sides to the same coin. And it's, you know, it's a good conference to attend. I think there's probably 600 or 700 people there. A lot of the, you know, the folks that are in the complex, a lot of senior folks. And it's about a 2.5-day conference. And it opened up, as it often does, with a keynote. And that keynote this year was Teresa Robbins, who is the acting administrator of NNSA. Of course, we have a nominated administrator, but we don't have a confirmed administrator yet. So Teresa Robbins is the acting, and she gave an update on what's going on in the labs. And it was, you know, it was a lot of sort of what you might expect in terms of, you know, we had our first diamond stamped pit last year. I think it was last year was also when NIF achieved, you know, fusion. And, you know, so there were some sort of big moments for the lab. But one of the things, and this is something I would, you know, toss over to you, was there's a lot of discussion, and it started with the acting administrator, over some of the big building projects. So, you know, UPF at Y-12, PF-4 at Lanol, SRPPF, the pit facilities at Savannah River. And, you know, part of the challenge, and maybe Jim, you can sort of kick us off with this, is these are facilities like UPF, I think, is in its 16th year of construction. And of course, it's, you know, I don't think the DOE has Nunn-McCurdy, but Nunn-McCurdy breaches. But, you know, these other facilities, the pit facilities like at Savannah River, are over budget, over time. And, you know, we're not expecting them to be, you know, to reach their IOC, initial operational capability, for another, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. And we're at a point where we have, you know, two very clear peer adversaries and a third adversary, you know, rapidly moving up the ranks. And yet we're really struggling to build 80 pits a year. And of course the Russians can build 1,000, and, you know, pits age over time and they have issues. So, you know, in terms of trying to get facilities online for, you know, uranium enrichment, or, you know, we've got to have lithium. Lithium's a key component in what we're doing. We've got all kinds of things that we need, but we're really struggling. And this was sort of one of the big topics of the, you know, of the symposium or of the summit. And so I'm sort of curious for you, Jim, as you, you know, because you're the engineer in this group, can you help us understand why some of these kinds of facilities, I mean, they're not just building a apartment building or even a high rise or anything like that. They are special and different, but are they so different that they need to take, you know, 15 or 20 years to do them?
So let me start again by saying it's not the engineer's fault. Okay. Engineers can build these things fairly well and fairly rapidly. The science is very well established. I mean, don't get me wrong, yeah. The national labs and what they're doing and what they're trying to accomplish, it's cutting edge, but it's not cutting edge to the impossible. It's cutting edge to making things more efficient, using better materials that we haven't used in many years. So, you know, a lot of the oversight, and there's good oversight. There's very good oversight, and then there's oversight, and then there's logistics and componentry, you know, vendor issues, et cetera. And we as a country have got wrapped around that other piece, that logistics piece that we can't seem to break into. You know, every time I talk to someone about a logistics issue, and I won't mention senior leaders that I've talked to, but I've spoken with senior leaders about specific projects, and I go, well, the problem is so burdensome in our service. I'll just leave it alone at that. And my answer to them is, well, who's in charge? I mean, after all, somebody's got to make that decision and someone's got to, you know, brush away some of the pieces. Now, they are complex. These processes, especially when you work with nuclear weapons and nuclear materials, are extremely complex because of the probabilities for accidents and mistakes that may happen, the moving of materials that have to be secured, et cetera. So they're very, very specialized. So, you know, building a nuclear weapon isn't, you know, 23 components, stick them together and it works like a car, you know, which is simple to build. Okay. But rather, it has to work well, and it has to work in these very, very austere environments. So testing and evaluation and spinning that up and making sure that we know what we have is important. Now, that said, I will agree with your pretext, Adam, that, well, this is just taking too long, because not the engineering that's making it take a long time. It's all these other issues, for example, EPA, safety inspections, oversight. And you have we don't have a workforce. I mean, this is an endemic problem in the United States. Do you want a person who has not been, you know, validated to work in a nuclear facility, even running electrical lines or putting up components in a system that haven't been vetted appropriately? I mean, there comes a point at which it becomes very difficult to do this. I've gone into high schools and colleges. In fact, I think Curtis was with me one time in a college of maybe it was Kirk Fancher and I. We were together in a college, and I said to the students there, I said, the number one thing that's going to get your foot in the door in working on most of these things is that you don't have a federal crime record. You don't have a drug record. How many of you could pass that at at this point? Because it is that important, and that becomes part of the problem. So it's a much bigger problem than, well, we just take too long, but it does need to be broken in terms of a broken through. But again, I'll go on the other side. You have one nuclear weapon mistake, one nuclear weapon accident. I mean, in a lifetime of the United States, how many bombs have accidentally gone off in a storage facility?
Zero.
Wow. That is a safety record that I would tell anyone in the world, try to meet our safety record. Zero. Out of the tens of thousands of nuclear weapons that we've had and moved around in really weird places, zero have accidentally gone off. You know,
yeah, but I guess
there's
my
a lot
question
to be said
is,
for that.
I agree with you, but are we to the point? I mean, let's go back to the Manhattan Project.
Yep.
You moved incredibly fast. And that was the largest project in the history of the country.
And there were accidents, by the way. People were killed in accidents that occurred because we didn't understand what was going on. Just put that in your back pocket.
True, but we had some small, there were small issues. They were not major issues that, you know, leveled towns or, you know, did anything. You know, they were kept inside the fence. Yeah. And I guess my question, though, is we're now you know, 80 years hence. Mm-hmm. And we know a lot more than we knew then. And we've had a lot of practice. So with a lot more knowledge, a lot more practice, we should be way better at this and pretty fast.
I don't disagree with you there. I'm just saying it's not just simply we could put things together quickly. We've got standards that we need to hold, and we got to make sure that we understand what we're doing as we move forward. However, we've done it before much, much faster. I'm not disagreeing with you there. I'm just saying it's complex.
I get that. But there was a great panel and a lot of discussion amongst attendees on this question of risk, mm-hmm. and risk tolerance. And, you know, I think somebody made the comment, you know, we're risk averse to the point that we want things to be 99.999999% safe. And that, you know, if we just reduce a few of the nines after the 0.9, that we could do things a lot faster and cheaper. Is that a valid, you know, critique, or is that sort of just hyperbolic, or?
Well, it is somewhat hyperbolic. Those numbers, I'm not sure how much they really mean in the end. I mean, if you think about it, the brakes failing you on your car occur about 1 in 1,000,000. Okay. So are you not going to drive your car? Because 1 in 1,000,000, you're going to, you know, have a brake failure. And let's sort of compare that to lightning. Lightning's about 1 in 1.2 million. You know, these numbers sort of lose some of their, you know, their flavor when you start really looking what these numbers mean. And I appreciate that. I agree. I think the people setting the standards don't even know what those standards mean or where they came from. I can guarantee it. It's a number, and it's a number based on failure recommendations by some sort of engineering standard. I do think there's a lot of room for improvement there, but I think the improvement also is in the logistics system and in the movement of materials from point A to point B and the restrictions we place on them. And I think we need a Manhattan-like project. I've said that before on this podcast. We need a Manhattan-like project that streamlines these, you know, these componentries and the components that to come to us so they function, and we can function in a way that we are credible. That's the big issue. I don't disagree with you. Those numbers, to me, and I'm a numbers guy, those don't mean as much to me as understanding the science behind each of these pieces of equipment and how they're tested and what they're tested to in terms of the environments they're tested to.
Yeah, there was also on the afternoon of day one a great panel talking about AUKUS. And Greg Meyer, who's a vice president at Fluor, you know, was on this panel, and he talked about sort of what Fluor's going through to, you know, partner with an Australian company and sort of be able to play in Australia. And, you know, it was interesting to hear all of sort of the hoops you have to jump through and just the differences and how their system works very differently. The structures for who owns, you know, they want to build, I think, like 6 submarines, 6 nuclear subs. I think that's what they're after. And just who all do you have to work with and, you know, what kind of rules you follow. And I thought that was a really interesting sort of discussion. And it sort of has broader relevance because as we think about potentially working with maybe the South Koreans or the Japanese or other allies on, you know, AUKUS type programs or whatever the other types of programs, you know, these are going to be the same kinds of issues that American companies that are going to have to partner with these local companies are going to have to deal with. And so it's certainly, you know, we have our own challenges, but then when you have to deal with your challenges, plus you have to deal with those of another country, and it's not automatically streamlined by the other country just because you're working on something important to the government, you know, you still have those same exact processes. So
yeah,
I'd say
I'd say one of the things in the U.S. though that is endemic in the way that our government functions is anytime there's a mistake or an error, I mean, people just run, you know, like, you know, you put light on cockroaches, everyone scatters. Like, who's in charge? And, you know, we don't have a culture of taking responsibility and saying, I'm in charge. It was my mistake. We're going to fix it. Let's move on. And hopefully we can return to that because you need that in order to not have, you know, stymie by committee, which is what we tend to see in, especially in the military. But you see that a lot in government oversight. Again, someone's got to say the buck stops here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's fair. But then somebody will, you know, if you sort of streamline a process, somebody will probably, you know, file a lawsuit or complaint, and you know that you're favoring one company over another. So it's always a challenge.
Yeah. And let me add to this, Adam.
Sure.
You know, first of all, welcome back.
Thanks.
You know, I think we are letting these kinds of detailed numbers, these requirements, really drive us into bankruptcy. This is 99.99999%. You know, every decimal point, you know, is an excuse for a contractor or someone to add more charge to the product that's being delivered to support the taxpayer's security. And I think that's something, you know, to consider here. I'd like to point out, just several days ago on January 28th, 2025, forgive me if I mess up the name here, Cheyenne Sankir, who is the chief technology officer of Palantir Technologies, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And of course, his testimony is public. And I'll just read you a sentence here out of it, which I thought is just really remarkable and is somewhat appropriate to what we're saying here. And he says that he told the Senate Armed Services Committee, the defense market is functionally a monopsony where the sole buyer shapes the market with overly prescriptive requirements, overly complex regulations, and five-year plans more reminiscent of the countries we defeated in the last century than America's free, innovative, and capitalist system. Unquote. I think it's I think he captured this quite succinctly, and I've said this in other podcasts. I'll sound like a broken record, and I'll say it again. Nothing should take 16 years to build, and if it does, it's because we're not making it a priority. We're not, for some reason, it is just not a priority to get it done. And as we've also said before, Adam, the longer you draw things out, the more expensive they get. Just look at your mortgage. And see how much more you pay for your home when you pay for it over a longer period of time. And so I just think that we are doing a disservice to our deterrence mission, our national security writ large, and to the taxpayers who are not only spending their dollars, but their ready debt to buy this stuff. And this is something that we have to be more considerate of.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because as I've thought about it, just spending all this time with NNSA folks and, you know, the MNO contractors and others, I wonder is, you know, if you think about the creation of NNSA, NNSA was not the AEC, the Atomic Energy
Commission. Energy Commission.
Yeah, so that mission was to grow, you know, they grew the nuclear arsenal. NNSA was created to oversee the decline and end of the nuclear arsenal. I mean, when it was created, what, it's about 30 years old, kind of at the end of the, near the end of the Cold War, we were going to go down, 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 and then we were going to achieve, you know, nirvana, and paradise was, and peace were going to break out, and no nuclear weapons would exist. And so it's, in some respects, and the labs, you know, got used to this. And you had people still at the labs who were cold warriors, who were skeptical of, you know, this. And then as those people have aged out and you've got younger people who have at the labs, great scientists, smart people, no question. But they're not used to building weapons and designing weapons. They've gotten involved in climate modeling and in, you know, all kinds of other things. And so
non-proliferation, right? Well, so much of their mission is non-proliferation.
And I wonder how much culturally, how capable can you take the ship of state and do that kind of dramatic turn with the people who have been there 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, all thinking that, hey, we're going towards zero. And now you said, well, that was a pipe dream. Thanks to, you know, Vladimir Putin, we're not going to do that anymore. And now you're like, hey, we got to build up a bunch. And your systems, in some respects, like, right, the production facilities, like, you know, Kansas City National Security Complex, they're sort of rapidly expanding and producing things because that's what they do. They build things. But I wonder about, you know, sort of in an NSA culture itself, like how they write contracts. Like, you know, do they write contracts with where they're, you know, mostly focused on slips, trips, and falls? Or do they, in you know, safety overall? Or are they writing, you know, contracts where it's get it done on time, get it done fast, get it done efficiently? And because historically it's been safety above all. And so has that sort of transition been made? And I'm not, you know, it's hard to say, but that's a big question.
Adam, I want to correct something. It's not about safety at all. It's about regulation. And that's the problem, because a lot of the regulation doesn't even lead to safety. I mean, The NRC tried to strip a lot of that away back, you know, when they did reviews on the power plant, the nuclear power plants. You know, a lot of the work was you don't put in place regulation that doesn't add to safety. You don't ask someone to maintain a piece of paper because you can. And I think that's part of where we are today, I think, is where we need to have the oversight changed in order to meet what Curtis is saying. Let's get the job done. Because I start everything out in the middle of the road and I look at both sides. And my answer is, you can't just say, here's a contract, go build nuclear weapons. And if we blow up a few cities on the way, or we contaminate the earth in some weird fashion, so what? We at least get our nuclear weapons, and that's what we're after. But no one's saying that. I know Curtis is giggling at me here. You know, no one's saying that. And the disarmament community sort of plays that game out, and Hollywood does too. No one's saying that. But we're also, you know, why, you know, I again recall at one point in my life when I was a radiation safety officer, I had a violation because I didn't have a piece of paper that had my signature on that had nothing to do with any of the other regulatory requirements, except that it was showed that I had my signature on a review. I had the document. I just didn't sign it at the time. Because I didn't sign it, it was a violation. Well, it didn't lead to anything unsafe. No one was less safe because I didn't put my signature on a piece of paper. And we get tied up in that, in these various components, where there has to be a view that there's the progress is important. It gets a priority, as Curtis says. I pointed on my screen here to Curtis in my screen. But there has to be a priority to what's important, and somebody has to set the standard. But I'm going to go back and say, someone has to be the buck stops here on both ends. Hey, that regulation is overburdensome. We need to pull it down, and I'll take the risk in that. Oh, that's different. Focusing on the whether it's the 14th decimal point or the 8th decimal point or 12th decimal point is, to me, a red herring that we chase that instead of chasing the human aspect of this. That's why I say the engineers aren't responsible for this problem. But it's people making these decisions that put us in this boat. And it's only people that will make decisions and carry that weight that have the leadership and the understanding well enough to be able to pull us forward. And without that, it will never happen, because someone will always find someone to the left or right to blame for what happens, good or bad.
So I think it's a little bit bigger than that. And I think that we have a workforce that does, I don't want to sound too pejorative to people, but may not understand the threat that we face now than more so than ever before. Realize that anybody under the age of 40, okay, has little appreciation for life in the Cold War. They would have been such small children in those upper 30s that they would not really have understood the experience. And so their formative years, of course, were in the 90s and beyond, where peace was breaking out, nuclear weapons were bad, there's no purpose for these things, and so forth and so on. And I think this is part of the reason why we have these kinds of obstacles. We should never trade safety or security for speed, but we should sacrifice speed and national security due to burdensome regulatory issues that are sometimes well-meaning, and in other times I think are not. That they are meant to slow down the process. They are meant to get in the way in the hopes that you'll never have to do this, or you know, the world will change. Maybe tomorrow, the Russians will wake up and decide they don't need their nuclear weapons anymore, and these sorts of things. The reality is that we don't explain well enough as a nation to the American people, and therefore ergo the American workforce that's in this space, why what this is so important, and that it's more than just making sure you got signatures on the right pieces of paper. It is about building national security in order to thwart the goals and intents of an adversary and trying to keep the global peace and stability while they're doing those bad things. And we have to be able to communicate that so the workforce wants to come to work and do this and understands that what they are doing is important to the national security and to the peace and stability of the world. And I just don't think we do a very good job of that. And to carry on in the political side of this, if you understand it to be a national security emergency, so to speak, right? President Trump has declared a national security emergency on the border. What's that do? It forces a whole bunch of action to occur, and resources to be mobilized in order to deal with an acute problem. Well, I would argue we're kind of in the same situation here when we talk about our nuclear arsenal. It's aging out. It's taking too long to build the replacement parts and the modernization and the workforce and all the other things. How long it's taking to build submarines all the modernization efforts are slipping to the right by 3 years, more or less. And all those slippages increase money and the cost again to the overall bill, and more importantly, as I've said before, I'm less worried about the money. I'm more worried about the time, because when the calendar keeps moving, you can't make that up, and we have to we need these capabilities now, and much less 2 years from now. Certainly 10-15 years behind schedule is not going to work. And so we've got to figure out a way to do this faster. And so I think you got to start, until you start holding accountability to those who are taking 16 years to build a building, then we're never going to solve those problems. So maybe signing those pieces of paper have some point to all of this.
Yeah, I think another piece that you hit on that, Curtis, that I think is important is there's a in our American, especially the American public, I won't speak for other countries, is that we lose familiarity with our nuclear weapon value and what it's there for and how it operates. And because of that, once you lose familiarity, people don't have context. When I hear about it, it's almost like a new item or a problematic item. And, I've mentioned this podcast before, what the French did in order to get the public to understand nuclear power. Yeah. What they did is they took children into the nuclear power plants in classroom environments multiple times a year, and they would get familiar with it. So when they become young voters and influential, when they graduated, it's like, there's a nuclear power plant down the road. Yeah, I've been there 100 times and nothing happened. And we have gotten so far away from that, from the Cold War, that people don't realize that. And then because it's unfamiliar, we don't put the focus on that. And we've got to get back there. That's part of the NIDS mission space, is to get the American public to understand that the weapons never went away. They never went away. Yeah. And they never stopped doing what they've been doing, which is deterring our adversaries. And we have to make sure that the American public understands that. And then the people will start pulling some of these pieces off of this, all these extra parachutes and everything else that has to be in the process, because it's getting in the way of doing what we're supposed to be doing.
I tell you, I
get excited about this.
I tell you, I think it's
blaming engineers.
Nobody's blaming engineers.
Nobody's blaming engineers.
Go ahead, Adam.
We're putting the blame where it belongs. Politicians.
That's right.
Bureaucrats. Well, so I guess I wonder, like when I would hear Air Force general officers, you know, give a speech, and they would say, you know, if I could put the genie back in the bottle, and if I could uninvent the nuclear weapon, I would, but I can't, so therefore we have to. And I always hated that. And I would say, hey, I would never uninvent nuclear weapons. Because when you uninvent nuclear weapons, you make the world safe for great power wars. And they consume, you know, the last one consumed half of the American gross domestic product and, you know, killed 100 million people and brought about communism in China. And the one before that killed 10 million and brought about communism in Russia. And, you know, so I would never get rid of them. So stop saying that. And so I think that's similar to when we say things like, well, we always want to make sure that the weapons are safe and that the facilities are safe. I don't even think that we really need to sort of offer up if we change, then it won't be safe.
Right.
It's, you know, it's always going to be safe. It's not move faster or not be safe.
Right.
That's not the sort of the issue that we're offering is speed or safety. Go ahead.
Yeah. Jim. Well, I let me give you an example, and it's one I've always used when I talked about risk with people, and that is it depends on what you mean by safe. So we have automobiles. I always like using automobiles because people are familiar with them, at least most people, except for way out in the boonies where you come from, Adam. But anyway, so you drive a car and you say, I'm safe. Well, I grew up at a time when we didn't have seatbelts in the car and we felt safe to sit in the car. But then we got seatbelts in our car and people are like, okay, now we're safe because we have seatbelts. But then we said, oh, but wait a minute. We have airbags. We got to put airbags in the car because we got to make ourselves safe. Like we weren't safe before when we didn't have seatbelts or when we got seatbelts. And I'll posit something that most of you will just sort of have a knee jerk to. If you really, the number one reason people are injured in automobile accidents is injuries to the head. Why aren't we wearing helmets in our automobiles? We want to be safe, right?
That's a great point, Jim.
I want you
to start the trend, by the way.
I already do.
Live by example.
I do. I wear a helmet. It has a little propeller on the top and everything. So,
see, my German Kaiser helmet tears up the interior of the ceiling of my car.
Oh, gosh. But my point is, what do you mean we're being safe? I mean, there comes a point. This goes back to your numbers game that you guys were playing with earlier. It comes a point. What is the, you know, where is the tolerance level? Where is the edge? We've got to have smart people along the way that say, where is the edge? Where is the risk? And where are we going to move forward? And will someone have their head injured if they're not wearing a helmet in an accident in a car today? I can guarantee you today, someone is going to be injured, maybe dead. And I'm sorry if one of our audience members is associated with any of those people, but that's going to happen today. And we're not wearing helmets. So why aren't we wearing helmets? And then let's even go one step further. If everyone drove only 20 miles an hour, imagine how much safer we would be. You know, so we get to these ridiculous things. We've got to set a standard, as Curtis said. What is the purpose behind our weapons? Because eventually you get to the point where your automobile's not doing crap for you, or your nuclear weapons aren't doing crap for you because you can't build them and make them and maintain them because you got all these logistics safety oversights. So my whole point of that is somebody has to step in and take and say, this is it. This is our tolerance level, and explain why. And we have to get a public that understands why. And we have to communicate that well, like we're doing in this podcast.
Adam? Well, you know, it's been an interesting discussion, but unfortunately, as with just about every single episode we have, we've run out of time. And so we'll have to sort of cut the discussion off there. I guess, you know, my final thoughts would be it was a great conference. So for those of you who have never been, but you're professionals in the nuclear enterprise, start saving now because it isn't the cheapest conference you'll go to by any stretch. But it's a great place to go see people you may know, to network, to, you know, sort of grow your contacts. It's a, you know, it's a great place to go. And if you're at one of the MNOs or one of the primes in the enterprise, you might want to talk to your boss about sending you next year because it's certainly informative. Did you have one last word, Jim?
I have a couple last words. So first of all, to our audience, if you find our podcast entertaining, let other people know. If you need something like some listening cards, some cards to hand out to your friends to show you have really good pals in the National Institute for Deterrence Technology. National Institute for Deterrence Studies. I was thinking
we're now NITS. We're NITS.
Well, some of us are. Anyway, but if you want to write to me at nids@thinkdeterrence.com. I'll get some stuff out to you because I hand out to your friend. I want to get the world to know who we are about this great mission that we have. The second thing I want to highlight is a few numbers for everybody in our audience. So just when you talk about cars, I looked this up before the show. Dying in a car accident, 1 in 107 over a lifetime, okay? Drowning, 1 in 121,000 over a lifetime. Is there how much you worried about drowning? Okay, there's the numbers. Okay.
Did you say 1 in 107 or 1 in 107,000?
1 in 121 over a lifetime.
I'm talking about drowning. A car.
Oh, 1 in 107 over a lifetime.
That's like a 1% chance.
Yep. Over a lifetime. According to the statistics, I pulled up a risk statistics. Home catching fire, 1 in 3 over a lifetime. A lot of home fires, actually. I'm dying from a bee, hornet, or wasp sting, 1 in 59,000 over a lifetime. Okay, let me catch some other ones that are sort of interesting. Finding a four-leaf clover, 1 in 10,000. Okay. Cracking open a double-yolked egg, 1 in 1,000. And here's my favorite, too. Okay, and these are probably ones that Adam has the biggest problems with. Being killed by falling furniture, 1 in 5,500. Okay, and getting injured by a toilet, 1 in 10,000, according to the odds of 50 random events website. So just give you an
idea. I'm surprised there's any humans left in this world.
Not a statistic on how your chances of getting killed by a nuclear weapon?
You know, I didn't put that in there, so... Anyway, so I thought I'd pass some numbers out at the end of this.
I would imagine it's pretty low.
Way lower than this. Well,
way lower than that.
There we go.
At any rate, we've got to wrap up. So thanks to you, the listeners. Remember, you can check us out. There's NIDS, this podcast here. And then, of course, we've got Real Space Strategy. And then Deterrence Down Under is, they're going to break out. And I think they're going to start doing some more. Add additional podcasts. And so you're going to have, the NIDS View, you're going to have Real Space Strategy, you're going to have Deterrence Down Under, and then there's Global Security Review, and then there's, Curtis's tweets are always interesting. And of course, there's the NIDS Academy if you want to take any of our courses. And, we're working, I think we could say this, we're working on a book right now that we'll have out hopefully before, in the next six months or so. So we're, we're doing a lot. I've got one of our fellows has offered a paper we're working on to look at the ICBMs. So there's always a lot going on at NIDS. And, you can read, you can listen. We don't produce any food, so we're not going to go after your taste, but... we'll go after your other senses. And so keep paying attention. Stay plugged in. Thanks for listening. And of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.